Okay, welcome back to everybody after the summer break. As ever, there are a few sidrot that we tend to miss over the summer. That's Shoftim, but we're back now to Ki Teitzei. And a very, very full sedra. No narrative whatsoever, but lots and lots of mitzvot. It's the biggest single number of mitzvot we have in any sedra. A number of the mefarshim do try to find links between the various mitzvot, why particularly these mitzvot in this sedra, what it's got to do with the impending entrance into Eretz Yisrael, etc., etc., and also why sort of they come in particular orders, what's the relationship of one mitzvah to another. So those are themes which are addressed by some of the mefarshim. Don't want to particularly look at them this evening, want to look at 4, 5, 6 of the mitzvot that appear in the parasha and to give them some consideration. So let's start off at the very beginning of the sedra. Ki teitzei la'milchama al oyevecha, when you go out to war against your enemies, and natanu Adonai Elohecha b'yadecha v'shavita shivyo, and Hashem gives them into your hands and you take some of them captive. Now this is the mitzvah of eshet yafat toar, the mitzvah to do with if you find a beautiful woman on the battlefield, the circumstances under which you're allowed to take her captive and to marry her. But even before we get to that, let's just look at the opening words of the Bal HaTurim on this week's parasha. The Bal HaTurim notes that last week's sedra of Shoftim finished with the mitzvah of the Egla Arufa and concluded with the words Ki Ta'aseh HaYashar Be'inei Hashem, that you should do what is just and upright in the eyes of Hashem. And then this week's sedra begins, the next pasuk, Ki Teitzei La'Milchama Al Oyevecha, when you go out to battle against your enemies. What does the Bal HaTurim say? Ki Ta'aseh HaYashar V'Samich Lei, there's a juxtaposition to Ki Teitzei La'Milchama, meaning She'en Yotzim La'Milchama Elat Tzadikim. The only people who should go out to war are tzadikim, meaning that the way you can be, I don't know if you can be assured of anything, but the best way of being assured of victory in battle is that you send out people to war, Ki Ta'aseh HaYashar Be'inei Hashem, people who do what is upright in the eyes of Hashem. You don't want to send out a group of thugs. I once saw a documentary on television that we were on holiday or something, there was this program about the British Army, and an enormous number of recruits of the British Army are people who are out, you know, come out of prison, and they sign up for the army. That's I don't know if those are necessarily people of Ki Ta'aseh HaYashar Be'inei Hashem. That's, you know, people of the most upstanding morality. But the point that the Bal HaTurim is making for us is that if we want Hashem to protect us, then the best way of being guaranteed any sort of protection is if our mitzvot and our behaviours are good behaviours, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be favourable to us. What else does the Bal HaTurim tell us? Ki Teitzei, that's this is perhaps a little political, the implications of this comment. Ki Teitzei, when you go out to war, Tzei Aleihem means you should go out to battle against your enemies. V'al Tanichem Lavo Alecha, don't wait for them to attack you. Pen Yashchitu Ha'aretz, in case they destroy the land. That battle isn't always defensive. Sometimes it has to be preemptive. Some people would like to say that, you know, we should never take the first blow. That's we should never initiate a battle. Bal HaTurim is telling us, Ki Teitzei, sometimes you have to go out and have to initiate the war. That is a matter of self-preservation. Now, Rav Moshe Sternbach, in his Sefer Tam Vadat, we've looked at this Sefer on a number of occasions, Rav Moshe Sternbach makes an interesting observation about this first pasuk. Patach b'lashon yachid ki teitzei. The sedra begins with the in the singular. That it doesn't say kitetsu when you go out in the plural. It says kitetsu when you as an individual go out. That's a little bit strange because, you know, if you go out as one soldier fighting a war by yourself with nobody around you, then you don't necessarily stand a lot of chance. Va'amar aloyevecha l'shon rabin. You've got, it's not just, you know, battling against one individual enemy soldier, it's aloyevecha. That's in the plural. That's your enemies in the plural, not the singular. That's the point. That's v'nirehata.
It's talking to someone as an individual because it's talking about if you see a beautiful woman.
You're right. You're 100% right. You're 100% right. What we're having, you're saying pshat, and what Rav Moshe Sternbach is saying is drash. That's the point. We're going to see. This is clearly not the pshat of the pasuk. What he's saying. That's it's a drash, and it's a drash which is suitable for Elul. But you're right. In the exact context of pshat, what you're saying is correct. V'nirehatam. So it would seem, when a person goes out to war, an individual soldier goes out to battle, he needs to say, to himself, everything, the victory or the defeat, is dependent on him. And he shouldn't be dismissive of his role. Lomar, look, you know, the enemy, there's so many of them. Who am I? Now, what difference can I make? The only way we can beat them and defeat them is if we have many, many soldiers. I'm just, one soldier. I make very little difference to the overall impact. That's not so. The victory is dependent on the involvement of individuals. It might be lots of individuals coming together, but every individual makes their mark. So nobody can loosen their grip on the situation or cause others to lose their grip on the situation. What he's saying is that ki teitzela milchama, it's true that you're part of a wider army, but you need to recognize your own importance in that battle. And that every single soldier on the battlefield makes a difference to the chances of success for his side. And I think that's true, not only in the sense of when we're soldiers on the physical battlefield, but anything else we're involved in as well. That we might have thought that, what difference does one person make? You know, what impact can I even as an individual have? Ki teitzei la milchama lo evecha. Every soldier, whatever the battle it is that we're fighting, but every soldier can make an impact and a difference, and we've all got something to contribute, even if it's only in adding to the total power. But beyond that, we've also got as individuals something that we can contribute to that cause. So that is al derech hadrash. It's not the pshat, but it's al derech hadrash. Now the mitzvah of the Eshet Yifat Toa, this beautiful woman, is a challenging mitzvah in terms of its ethical message and its morality. You know, the notion of being able to take a woman from the battlefield, capture her, and to have intercourse with her. And there's discussion amongst the Mefarshim and the Poskim exactly how that applied itself, whether the person was, the soldier was allowed to have intercourse with her before marriage or only after marriage, what form the marriage took, etc., etc. Those are very big and challenging questions. And indeed, Rashi relates to those questions in his comment where he says, "V'lakachta lechalisha, you can take this woman as a wife." Lo dibra Torah ela keneged yetzahara. The Torah was making a concession towards a person's yetzahara, a person's weaker wills. She'imein HaKadosh Baruch Hu matira. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't allow the Eshet Yifat Torah to be taken, Yisa'era be'isur, then the soldiers are going to marry these women anyhow. You know, these are women they've captured on the battlefield. They took a fancy to them. They're going to marry them in anyhow. So therefore, the Torah wanted to give us a context in which that should be done. Aval ibn Sa'ab, but the soldier should know that if he does marry her, Sofaliot Sona, he's eventually going to come to hate her. He's not going to like her long term. Shenem Acharav, because the next parasha, the next paragraph begins, Kithiena Le'esh, when a man has Shtei Nashim, Ha'chatau Vavachat Snua, one that he loves and one that he hates. So we see the notion straight after the din of Eshet Yifat Torah. We have a mitzvah which talks to us about a hated wife. And the children that you get from such a wife are going to be no gooders. That's because the next parasha deals with the Ben Soro Mora, the rebellious son. So it's true you can do this. The Torah's not mad keen on it. And the Torah's suggesting to you that if you do it, it's not going to have a happy ending to it. That's why we've got these parashiot juxtaposed to each other, the first three paragraphs of Parashat Kitete. So Rashi is very clearly reflecting the notion that the marrying an Eshet Yifat Torah isn't an ideal. It's something that we frown on, and it's a concession to the needs of the battlefield. Now, we might well say that the Jewish soldier, even on the battlefield, should have exemplary morals. I mean, we see this, later on, that going out to war, that you have to avoid anything which is bad, anything which is evil. So how can it be that here at the beginning of the Sedra, that we've got this mitzvah of Eshet Yifat Torah, which really seems grossly inappropriate. So let's look at a comment of the Ramban. The Ramban has a lengthy passage on this, but I'm just taking out a few lines here for us to look at. Now, one of the rules applying to the Eshet Yifat Torah is that you bring her into your house and you you shave her head and either cut her fingernails or grow her fingernails, different opinions as to what that pasuk you'd bet means. V'hes pasuk yud gimel v'hes sirat simnat shivya me'aleha, and you remove the garments that she was wearing as a captive from her. V'yashva v'hes, you dress her in other clothes. V'yashva v'hetecha, and she sits in your house. V'achtash taviha v'etima yerachamim, and she cries about her family for a month. Look at what the Ramban says. Why do you have to take the garments that she was wearing when she was captured? Why do you have to remove them from her? Meaning you give her sackcloth or mourner's clothes to wear. Give her a black mourning dress to wear. And she sits in your house, ka'almana, as a widow, and she can't go out at all. And she'll cry for her parents. She does this for a month. That's how mourners behave. And according to Chazal, what was the purpose of all this? It's all there to make her beauty disappear, so that she should look ugly rather than beautiful. Might be that on the battlefield, when you've got sweat and grime pouring into your eyes, and you haven't eaten properly for 3 days, you haven't slept properly for a week, and you haven't seen a woman for a month, so this woman looks like a Greek goddess. Once you bring her home, sit her in the kitchen in a disheveled state, you come to your senses pretty quickly, and you'll send her back to where she came from.
That's,
That's possible as well. That's so Tsivasheta Sir Habagadim Hana Imme Aleha. Now, why was she wearing these beautiful clothes? That's, you know, is this combat gear? Combat gear is that she's wearing, you know, a fancy dress. That's Shagoyim Arurim Haim, because our enemies are accursed. Benotehem mit kashtot b'milchama. They send their daughters out to war, dressed up in, for want of a better expression, in sexy clothing to be alluring. Kedelis not acharehen, in order to entice the Jewish soldiers and to get them to commit znut with them, to get them to commit sexual acts with them. Either they can steal their hearts or steal their secrets or whatever it is. But the point is that the Ramban's making for us, and this is very important, these aren't innocent women. That's, you know, we're not talking about, and a number of the Mepharshim make this point, that we're not talking about a case where you go into a city, where you capture a city, and then you can take whichever women you like. You can't do that. That's not permissible. Here we're talking about on the battlefield where the enemy have sent out their wives and daughters, right, to ensnare you. So just as in warfare you capture soldiers, and certainly in ancient times, you know, you captured soldiers, you didn't send them off to some UN camp to be sent back home at the end of the war. You know, you captured soldiers and they became your slaves. So in the same way, these women, they were soldiers. They weren't wielding conventional weapons. They were wielding sensual weapons. But they'd put themselves into this situation. They'd gone out to have sexual intercourse with Jewish soldiers, to lead the Jewish soldiers astray. Right? So now you're taking them as a wife. That's it's not as terrible as it sounds. You know, this isn't we're not looking at a poor, you know, a virginal girl who's been dragged from her bed, kicking and screaming to be raped by a group of soldiers. Chalila v'chas. We're talking about a woman who's dressed herself up to try and seduce Jewish soldiers. She's being taken as a wife. And even though the Ramban doesn't mention this, but the Poskim do, and it's clear from the Psukim, that we're not talking about maltreating these women. We're talking about v'lakakta l'chali isha. You marry this woman, she becomes your wife, and you've got all the responsibilities of a Jewish husband to this wife. You can't just... You can't treat her as a slave woman. You can't treat her as a sexual object. You can't use her as a subject of rape. That there are some divergent views on this matter, but certainly a very clear, straightforward reading of these pesukim is lachakta lachalisha. This woman becomes your wife. And as the Ramban says, what's the whole negative? You know, why is the Torah so much against this? You know, you're taking her as a wife, so you're not maltreating her. What is there to feel uncomfortable about? So the Ramban says, can tell you what there is to feel uncomfortable. That's you're converting her Baal Korcha. She went out to battle to conquer Am Yisrael. Now she's being dragged into a Jewish home. She has to become Jewish. Now she doesn't want to become Jewish. Okay, well, she'll be taken to the mikveh. She'll be Olivia. She'll be dumped in the mikveh, and she'll have to observe Jewish law. So she becomes Jewish. She doesn't want to become Jewish. She's not going to be the Eshet Chayil you've always aspired to. That's, you know, that's when you're in shul on Friday night. She's not going to be reading Tzena or Ena at home. It'll be Hello Magazine instead. She's not going to be the Kisara Rivka Rachel Valea. So if you really want to marry her, the Torah is allowing you to marry her. You have to treat her as with dignity. She becomes your wife. She puts herself into that situation, so she's not being wantonly raped. But you know what? It doesn't make a good Jewish marriage. Tal. Yes. Yeah, we'll look. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Just in terms of one of the things that's always bothered me about this is how do you get her to cry for a man?
You know what? I don't know if that.
It says that all the other things you can either do forcibly or whatever the story is, you can shave her hair, you can do something else, you can do all.
Maybe you can't force her. That's.
You can't force her to cry for a while.
Vayashav Vitach, she will sit in your house. I don't know if it's prescriptive, it might be descriptive. That's most likely she thought, you know, she went out, you know, to battle. That's, you know, being promised that, you know, if she can, you know, she, you know, dressed up, you know, wonderful future, you entice, you know, anybody who entices 20 Israelite soldiers and poisons them in their sleep, that, you know, is going to be able to marry, you know, the prince of the kingdom, whatever. And what did she find? She finds that instead of being in a royal palace, she's now dragged off to this Jewish home. She's in a kitchen having to make cholent and kugel, you know, for the rest of her life. You know, never to see her family again. Yeah, it's probably she'll cry. If she doesn't cry, then, you know, I don't think that's an impediment to it. Okay. Let's have a brief look at the Bensora Umorah. Bensora Umorah, the rebellious son, which, according to a certain opinion in the Gemara, never was and never will be. It's only there, drosh v'kabel schar. It's there for us to learn, to spend time studying the laws. In fact, Chazal, the Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin. So we'll probably have a couple of shirim on it on Shabbat afternoons. In due course, it's the eighth perek. That's Bensora Umorah. It's, you know, it's very specific. It's not just, you know, your son is being rebellious. You know, you're despairing, so you drag him to Beit Din. That's there are certain things he has to have done: drunk a certain amount of wine, eaten a certain amount of meat. He needs to be a certain age, between 13 and 3 months. His parents need to various dinim about the parents. We're going to see about this in just a moment. They need to be the same height, speak with the same sort of tone. Etc., etc. So it's very limited. Chazal didn't want that, you know, teenagers can be difficult. Chazal didn't want that people to be putting their teenage children to death all the time just because they stayed up late at night and didn't do so well in their exams.
That's outside
yeah. So if it wasn't going to happen, that's never happened, it never will happen. Drosh v'kabel schar means more than just, you know, well, sit in the base of Medrash and learn it, and it's another parsha for you to learn. It means drosh v'kabel schar, you know, get, you know, learn it and apply the lessons, and then you'll get a reward. Now, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch makes an interesting observation about the background to this mitzvah, and I think it's worth us seeing. He says, this law which pronounces the death sentence over a youthful delinquent as being incurable and declares his early death to be the one means of salvation from later complete denigration. Bensora Umora Nidon al Shem Sofo, Yamut Zakai Val Yamut Chayav. This is the Gemara, which says that, you know, Bensora Umora, he hasn't actually done anything which is so terrible. He's put to death because they could see that he was going to get worse. Kill him before he does anything really terrible. Fixes that sentence on quite sharply defined factors of age and behavior, but quite specially on the relations of the parents to each other and to the son. Only if the parents work harmoniously together and completely hand in hand can the parental task of educating their children be achieved, and the fault to lie in the incorrigible nature of the son. But just thereby is given the most significant indication of those factors which every successful bringing up of children must start with. We went at great length, very deeply, into these factors in the article referred to above. Again, he's going to go on to talk about more. But the point that he's making is, if you look in the Psukim, that's Pasuk Yud Chet, right? Einenu shomer b'kol aviv v'kol imo. He doesn't listen to the voice of his father or his mother. Ve'yisaru otor, they discipline him. and he doesn't listen to them. The tafa suvor avivimo, and his father and his mother take hold of him. The hot siuoto, and they bring him out. The amaru, and they say, b'neinu zeh, our child, our son, einu shomer b'koleinu, doesn't listen to our voice. It's the parents working in tandem. That's what it has to be. So if the parents aren't working, and that's why you've got to be worried. That's why if the parents are working in tandem, and still the son seems wayward is an understatement, seems to be a bensoro mora, then you can assume that something is really wrong, and you're not going to be able to correct it. If the parents aren't working in tandem, then you know maybe that's the problem. In terms of Rav Shemshon Farish is asking, why is it, you know, he hasn't done anything wrong or so terrible yet. We're going to put him to death because we think this is a person who's got no chance of redeeming himself. Surely, child should be able to redeem himself. Why can this child not redeem himself? He's only irredeemable if, even though both his parents are singing from the same hymn sheet and he's not following them, then there's something really wrong. If they're not following from the singing from the same hymn sheet, so maybe the problem is with the parenting rather than the child himself. And I think this is a very important lesson that Rav Hirsch is trying to teach us with regard to the role of both parents working together in the upbringing of their children. Now, a question asked by a number of Mefarshim is, why is it that the punishment for the Ben Soro Mora is Urgamuhu Kolan She'iro Bavanim Vameit, that he gets skila, that he gets stoned? So I suppose one could say, well, you know, because he drank so much, so he got stoned, so he gets put to death by stoning. But beyond that, the real question is that for stealing and even for killing, that's you get saif, you get beheaded, you don't get skila. Skila is reserved for very particular sins, and this seems out of proportion for what he's doing. That's a question which is asked by a number of the mafarshim, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, in his commentary on Chumash, that he says that it's so that there should be more publicity. You know, this is everybody's got to learn from the lesson of the Ben Soro Mora. The Ben Soro Mora, you know, this is a terrible situation. And even though he hasn't actually done anything terrible yet, we're concerned that he will do something terrible, and it's a lesson to parents and children alike, and therefore give the punishment of stoning. That's also suggested by the Torah Tamima as well.
the whole idea, I know in practice it didn't happen, but even to have a paragraph in the Torah that you haven't done anything really badly wrong yet, because he's going to be stoned to death, it doesn't make sense.
So I think that's the challenge that the Mefarshim have got, and I think that's why the Mefarshim say it never happened and it never will happen. But what we've got to do is we've got to try and see what message is the Torah trying to give us. It's a very restricted law in terms of the Psukim tell us he was Zolel v'Sovei. Right? He was drunkard and a glutton. Glutton and a drunkard. Right? So as Roland says, that's not a reason to put him to death. Okay, we're concerned about what he will become. Nidon al shem sofo. That's ultimately he's going to be mesate mit abriot, etc. He's going to steal and he's going to murder, etc. That's what can happen, and therefore he's put to death. Now this never happened, but this is Torah telling us, there's a tendency, your child is wayward, so, you take him to the doctor, you take him for counselling, and you come out and say, yeah, so long as he loves his mother, it's all right. That's, no, don't make the mistake of thinking so long as he loves his mother, it's all right. That's it. You should see that you don't nip this in the bud early, then it can turn into terrible things. Now, the pshat of the psukim is you nip it in the bud in a very radical way. You put him to death for not doing very much. Chazal constrained it, contracted it, reduced it. There's only very, very specific circumstances in which this can happen. But the lesson is still an important lesson. That's, you see your kids starting to be wayward. You need to take the matter in hand rather than just to shrug and say you'll grow out of it. The psukim aren't shrugging and say you'll grow out of it. You've got to deal with it early on. Okay. When you build a new home and you make a, you need to make a marker, a parapet, a fence for your roof, so you don't bring blood guilt into your house. If anybody falls off, this is actually two mitzvot, an asay and a lot asay. The asay is vasita marker, and the lot asay is lot asim damim veitecha. You shouldn't have anything dangerous in your house. The last siman in Shulchan Aruch at the end of Choshen Mishpat deals with these dinim. That's a number of practical applications. We tend to think, oh, a parapet around your roof. Well, who uses their roof? That's we don't go onto our roof, so you don't need a fence around it. But it might well be that even say the stair rail, the banister up your stairs. That's the mitzvah of Vasita Marke Legagecha. And that's a high place where people could fall, and therefore you need there to be sufficient things there to stop you falling, or certainly railings on the top, the top landing, and that sort of thing. Also, a prohibition against having dangerous things in your house where a person could. Could injure themselves, be killed. That's, if you've got a garden pond or something like that and got young children, then it seems there's a mitzvah min ha-Torah, v'lot asim damim v'veitecha. You have to make sure that it's covered with a net or something like that so that a kid doesn't fall into it, etc. In any event, there's a very interesting netziv here, commenting on the fact, ki tivneh bayit chadash, you build a new house, v'asita ma'akel gagecha, you make a fence for the roof. The Sifri Mevuadin Bayit Yashan. The Sifri, the Midrash Halacha, tells us it doesn't need to be just for a new house that you have to put up a fence. Not an old house, but the fence fell down, or there wasn't a fence, you bought a house, whatever, you need to put the fence up as well. V'hadichtiv Bayit Chadash. So why did it say Bayit Chadash? Why doesn't it just say Ki Tivneh Bayit, or Ki Yeshcha Bayit, when you have a house? Why is it Ki Tivneh Bayit Chadash? Ba'alam deinu, it's coming to teach us, da bone bayit chadash, when you build a new home, ra'ui liyasta al mitat mitzvah batchila. It's appropriate to establish your house by doing a mitzvah right at the very beginning. V'achim avoa b'zohar parsha mitzora. He's quoting us a Zohar. V'shem hachi tziva Hashem lachin beito b'mitzvah ma'akeh. And that's why we've got the mitzvah of ma'akeh right at the very beginning. When you build your house, you put up a marker. Padalokitiv came with mitzvah mezuzah. So why doesn't it say with the mezuzah as well? That's when you build a house, you put up a marker and a mezuzah. Humishum di mezuzah ela talu bevinyan bayit kolkach. Mezuzah, you don't have to put the mezuzah up when you build the house. Mishum di misha ein lo mezuzah, rashai la tor b'lo mezuzah. You're actually allowed. What happens if you haven't got a mezuzah? You're going to live. You're going for work. I don't know where to live in some. You're being posted in Japan, the middle of nowhere, right? For a year on work. So you go there. No Jews where you're going. So you're renting a property. You take all your mezuzot and everything. So to put them up as soon as you get there, and you arrive in the middle of Japan, wherever you are, and so you find, the bag with the mezuzot, that bag went missing. You haven't got your mezuzot. Can you live in your house? You know, till Chabad of Tokyo arrive with more mezuzot, it's going to be a week already. That's, well, what are you going to do? So what, you know, you're allowed to live in the house even, without a mezuzah. Right, shalav mitzvah likbo mezuzah kishayasig. You have to put up a mezuzah when you get one. Masha'ein kein marka. That's not the case with marka. Talu bevinyan habayit. That's, depends on, you know, when you build the house. Da'asur la'dor b'li marka. You can't move in till you've put up the marka. That's why it's talking about the mitzvah of makah rather than the mitzvah of mezuzah. But the point he's making, very important notion, is a new home, that's you, the first thing you do in a new home is a mitzvah. That's, I think I mentioned this once before, perhaps in a drasha, one Shabbat. That's, I remember one time somebody in the community, that's, they phoned me up, that's, can you come, we just moved into our new house today, that's, can you come round this evening and say a Dvar Torah for us? That's, they wanted, it was lovely. The first thing they wanted to do in their new home was have somebody come round and say a Dvar Torah and drink a l'chaim. That's, I was happy to do both. That's, but it was a very powerful idea. That's, you know, the first thing you do in your home is, you know, is a mitzvah. That's, and, you know, people here are thinking at some stage of moving. That's, you know, make sure the first thing you do, that's, is that mitzvah. That will define the home and the house that you are establishing. Let's move on. Oh, okay. You know what? We'll skip that chatam sofer for now. Ki yeriv bein anashim v'nikshur. This is much later on in the parasha, towards the end. Perek kafei. Ki yeriv bein anashim v'nikshur al mishpatu shvatum. So there's an argument, a dispute between people, and they come to the courts to. Have the case judged. The innocent party is declared innocent and the guilty party is declared guilty. Drashot in the Gemara as to why we need to say that. That's, we learn out Edim Somamim from this, a certain dinim of Edim Somamim. V'hayayim bin ha-kot ha-rasha. Now, if the wicked one deserves malkut, deserves lashes, v'pino ha-shofet, so the, judge will lie him down, but he kaulufanav and give him makot. Kedei rishato b'mispar, translated by count as his guilt warrants, arba'im yakenu lo Yosef. That's, you give him 40 lashes, lo Yosef, and you don't do any more than that. Pen Yosef lakoto aleinu makarabav niklach chicha aleinecha. In case you give him too many, and he becomes degraded before you. So this is the mitzvah of Malkut Arba'im. Malkut Arba'im means how many lashes? 39. That of course is the question. That's the big question. Malkut Arba'im. Pasuk tells us Arba'im, 40. And we know that Malkut Arba'im is 39. That's how do you translate 40? It's the 39. So where do we get 39 from? That's, if it says in the Pasuk 40. So I haven't got the Rashi in front of us here. But Rashi says, looking at the end of Pasuk Bet, going into Pasuk Gimel, he says, Kedei Rishato B'mispar. Doesn't say Kedei Rishato B'mispar with a patach underneath. It says B'mispar. It says we should read it together with the next pasuk. So kedei rishato, v'kalufanav kedei rishato. You give him lashes according to his wickedness. B'mispar arba'im. Now he says, if it said b'mispar arba'im, that would be absolute. So 40. B'mispar arba'im means with the number that leads to 40. The number that leads to 40 is 39. Now I think. I hope it's not radical, particularly radical to say this. I think what Rashi's doing is he's got the rabbinic tradition that it's 39. And what he's doing is, you know, the Pasuk says 40. Everybody knows, according to Chazal, it's 39. We can't just say that Chazal were ignoring the Pasuk, so we need to read it in somehow. Therefore, it must be that Kedei Rishator, and then B'mispar Arba'im Yakenu, that's the number that leads to 40. I don't think if Rashi hadn't had this tradition of Chazal, that Malkut Arba'im means 39, I don't think he would have read it that way. So yeah, it means 40. That's, even though he's presenting it, yeah, of course this is the way to read it, but Mispar Arba'im, he has to do that because of the rabbinic tradition that it's only 39 Malkut. So that's Rashi's way of reading it. But as I say, it wouldn't automatically be obvious to us that that's the way to understand the Pasuk. So the Torah Tumimah gives us another suggestion as to why we only give 39 lashes rather than 40. Shubafaresh ad heichan shiur hamispar ad arba'im. So the Pasuk tells us how many, we were told, kedei rishato b'mispar, that you give him the appropriate number of lashes, arba'im, up till 40. V'im kein anu mesupakim. Now, question is, im ad bichlal, or lo ad bichlal? We've always got this question, is it up to and including, or up to but not including? Till a child is 13, they're not obligated in the mitzvot. Right? I mean, till they're 13, including when they're 13, or up to and not including when they're 13. You can't do a baby's Brit Milah, until the eighth day. Does that mean before the eighth day or even on the eighth day? You always got that question. Is it up to or up to and including? So, v'lachein ein lahakoto yoter milamutet. Therefore, we don't give more than 39. Pen yavru al lo yosef. In case you transgress the prohibition against giving too many, because the pasuk goes on to say, lo yosef, you shouldn't give more than the statutory amount, the maximum amount. So I don't know if the maximum amount is 39 or 40. So if I give 39, at least I haven't, I might not have given the maximum amount, but at least I haven't transgressed that. If I give 40, then perhaps I've got it wrong. So that's the Torah Tumimah's interpretation. Let's just look at least at part of what Reb Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg says in Haktava HaKabbalah. And we've seen on many occasions when we've looked at HaKtava HaKabbalah. Remember, his motivation in his commentary is always to show how the Midrash of Chazal is actually closely aligned to the text. That's what he always wants to do. He always wants to show us that it's not that the rabbinic tradition and the written tradition are not separate traditions, but really they go hand in hand. And in most cases, the rabbinic tradition actually reflects an interpretation of what is written there. So he's going to have for us a new understanding, a new translation of Arba'im Yakenu. Now, if we look at the Psukim, as we'll see, we've got in Pasuk Bet, in Bin Hakot Harasha, Vipilashofet Vihikahu Lefanav, and then in Pasuk Gim, we've got Yakenu and Lahakota and Makah. And we would have thought they're all from the same root. That's Yaket, to strike. He's going to suggest to us that's not the case. V'nir Eli She'en HaMuvan B'Milat Yakenu K'mo Asher Yakesh Etreyehu. I don't think that the word yakenu is the same as yakesh etreihu. It's anything to do with striking. Kimhu lashon chisaron v'giraon. Rather, it means something which is lacking. Hamurgal b'divrei chazal. And we see this often with chazal. They talk about, for example, menakel or min hadamin. Means you reduce the cost of something. That's mizeh ulai uchal nakebo. That ulai nuchal nakebo. That's pasuk elsewhere. Ulai nuchal nakebo. Perhaps we'll be able not to strike it, but Shepirash Rashi, ulai uchal lahasir mehem ma'at. Perhaps we can reduce them somewhat. And that's what he goes on to give a number of other examples. And even he says the word ach, Ach means sort of but, it means it's a limitation. So therefore he's saying Arba'im Yakenu, okay, where he says Arba'im Yakenu means you can read translated meaning Arba'im Yakenu should give him less than 40. That's from Lashon Nakeh. Nakeh, and in Hebrew, Nakeh is a person who's who's an invalid. He hasn't got full use of his limbs. So Arba'im Yakenu, that's you should reduce it from 40. Not full 40 lashes, but less than 40. That's a very creative way of understanding how even in the pasuk it says there shouldn't be full 40 lashes. Let's conclude with the very end of the Sedra, Parashat Zachor. We know it from the Shabbat, best perhaps as the Shabbat before Purim, when we read these Pesukim as the Maftir. Often say that that's the, you know, the one Kriya which is a Doraita. That's it's three Pesukim here in Parashat B'Shalach. At the end of Parashat B'Shalach, it's nine Pesukim. And Nechama Leibovitz, in her studies on Devarim, makes a number of interesting observations, which I think at least some of them we should look at. She starts off by saying, we may immediately perceive considerable variation between the two passages. In Exodus, we have a factual account of what happened. Amalek came and fought. There is no evaluation of the event. But in Deuteronomy, the wickedness of Amalek and the feebleness of Israel are thrown into relief. The destruction of the weak, how he smote the hindmost of you, all that were enfeebled, is emphasized. In Exodus, following the factual accounts, we have a divine decision, the program of the Almighty for wiping out Amalek and his eternal declaration of war against them. In Deuteronomy, however, this task of fighting Amalek is imposed on Israel. The difference may be said to derive from the divergent character of these two books of the Pentateuch. This is a particularly interesting thing. She's going to say the goals of Sefer Shemot and Sefer Devarim are different. Exodus, like Numbers, recounts the incidents that happened to Israel in the wilderness. In Deuteronomy, Moses devotes his attention to the precepts and tasks which would be obligatory on the people in their homeland in the organization of their social and political life in accordance with the will of God. As we have had occasion to mention before, Moses speaks as a historian in Exodus and Numbers, but as a lawgiver and moralist in Deuteronomy. I thought that was a particularly interesting distinction. As a historian in Shemot and Bamidbar, and a lawgiver in Devarim. The difference between the two passages becomes clear if we bear this in mind. Where the Almighty is setting forth his program for the future, there's no need to dwell on the cruelty of Amalek. The divine will stands in no need of motivation. Right, Parashat B'Shalach, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know, I'm waging war against Amalek. That's fine. God says he's waging war against Amalek. That's great. But in our Sedra, where Israel is commanded a specific precept, that of remembering blotting out Amalek, the awesome character of the task requires explaining for them. They need to know, why is it you've got to wipe out every single Amalekite? The Torah always strives to appeal to the heart and understanding of its audience. Okay, so far she's explained the difference between nine psukim in Parashat Shemot, in Parashat B'Shalach, because that's telling us what happened. Three psukim in Parashat Kitetze, because it's telling us what we have to do. And an added dimension in Parashat Kitetze, even though it's only three psukim, but the notion of Shekharcha Baderech Vatayefi Ageh V'lo Yare Elohim. That's because we need to understand why we're doing it. But in spite of all these explanations, commentators in all ages have been puzzled and even thunderstruck by the specific command to wipe out a whole nation and blot out its memory without reservation or qualification. And this is the big moral challenge of Parashat Amalek. That's, you know, that's people who've done nothing wrong, seemingly done nothing wrong, the whole nation, not everybody went to battle, and certainly not their descendants. Why does the whole nation need to be eradicated? Furthermore, and perhaps the solution lies in this direction, No other nation is described in the Torah by the phrase, V'lo yarei Elohim. We've got lots of enemies. Nowhere else does it say V'lo yarei Elohim. Such an outright condemnation of a whole people does not occur elsewhere. So what she then goes on to do is to say with the notion of Yirat Elohim appears four times in Chumash. It appears once in Parashat Vayera, Ki Amarti Rakein Yirat Elohim Bamakom Hazeh, where Avraham Avinu is explaining why he concealed Sarah. That appears again in Bereshit, chapter 42, in Parashat Miketz, Vayomer Elohim Yosef Zot Asu V'Chiyu Et HaElohim Ani Yarei. Okay, this is where Yosef is, speaking about, incarcerating Shimon. That's and he's saying that I fear God. That's Parashat Shemot with regard to the midwives, they feared God. That's and in Parashat Dvarim, there's also Parashat Kitesi and Sefer Dvarim, our pasuk, where we're told that Amalek v'lo yarei Elohim, he didn't fear God. So two cases where there is a fear of God, two cases where there isn't a fear of God. What is the common denominator of these contexts? What is the character of the fear of God that animates or should animate those who do not belong to the stock of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and have not accepted the yoke of the Torah and its precepts? Evidently, the criterion of God-fearingness in all these four contexts may be measured by the attitude of the subject to the weak and the stranger. Where the fear of God is lacking, the stranger who is homeless in a foreign land is liable to be murdered. Right? So Avraham Avinu was worried about what would happen to Sarah, or Sarai as she was then, because he thought, Rakein Yirat Elohim Bamakom Hazeh, there's no fear of God here. Likewise, Amalek attacked the weak people, V'lo yarei Elohim. On the other hand, Yosef was considerate towards the brothers, because Et HaElohim Ani Yarei, he feared God. And likewise, the Mialdot, they saved the vulnerable children, because V'atirena HaMialdot Et HaElohim, they feared God. So where there's an absence of fear of God, then there's cruelty. And that's the point that Nechama Leibovitz is making here. Why is it this whole nation has to be wiped out? Not just because they didn't fear God. Okay, so, they weren't religious. Being religious by not being religious by itself perhaps doesn't merit that they should all be wiped out. But them not fearing God is an explanation of why they then felt they could oppress the weak. You've got no fear of God, then you've got no weak people, you don't need to fear them either. You've got nobody to fear. And seeing as it was a characteristic of that nation, they didn't fear God, that's why they attacked the weak, and that's why the whole nation has to be wiped out. Because that's a characteristic of that nation, that they will attack the weak. The fact that they got no fear of God, they don't want to go to they don't want to go to pray, they don't want to do mitzvot, shevem mitzvot, b'nei nach even. You know, that in itself, that's maybe there's some salvation. But when you've got no fear of God, and therefore that you can attack the weak and the defenseless, so then it's a nation that has to be eradicated. Okay, I'd come with Parashat Ki Tetzeh, really just dipping into some of the themes. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, same time, same place, and we'll be looking at Parashat Ki Tavo.